Let's try that again. I'd like to call the House Committee on Transportation and Economic Development to order. I want to begin by thanking Representative Reed for the use of his grandfather's gavel. This is not
no,
your...
No,
someone's taking your grandfather's.
Yeah, we'll find it later.
I'll retract that. A couple of things. First, two items on our agenda today. The first is an informational meeting for the from the Oregon Department of Transportation. The second, an update on the Pacific Northwest Economic Region 2011 Summit in Portland. And also, there is a handout that I ask our committee administrator to pass out. This normally, I wouldn't do this, but the folks that brought it, rather than have them go to each one of our offices, I said it was okay to hand out, so I asked the committee's indulgence for that. We're not taking any public testimony today. We're just listening. So with that, I would like to open the informational meeting and call Matt Garrett, Director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. You have such a small department, it shouldn't take over just a few minutes.
No, we'll bang this out very quickly, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Matthew Garrett. I'm the director of the Oregon Department of Transportation. It's a pleasure for me to be here. I'm going to speak to you about five things for all intents and purposes and various levels within the issue areas, and I would suggest that each and every one of these probably could be a standalone issue, to be very honest with you, but we'll do the overview today. And we look forward to partnering with this committee as we move through the legislative session and taking on the transportation issues. If I can beg the committee's indulgence, I have brought my senior staff here. We've had some face changes at the Department of Transportation as well. And I'd just like to have my Deputy Director for Operations, Jerry Bohard, stand up, my Deputy Director for Central Services, Clyde Psyche, and then Paul Mather, who is overseeing the Highway Division as the new administrator. That's the senior staff for all intents and purposes within my agency. I believe they're some of the best and brightest in state government, and then we are led by our fearless legislative leader, Robin Freeman, who does a great job for us. So with that, I thank you. Department of Transportation was established back in 1969, and it oversees a lot of activities that affect and touch people's lives every day. We are divided up into nine divisions. The Highway Division, which is about two-thirds of what we do for all intents and purposes, everything from the basic environmental work to the project development to the project delivery to the project maintenance, the hard science that move in there, from right-of-way to geotech-type type activities to bike-ped facilities to working with local governments. It is a significant piece of our portfolio. We have transportation development, our long-term planning arm within the agency. It also collects all the data that we use to inform the discussions with regard to policy and programs. Our transit division, working with the federal government to make sure we are securing opportunities for inner city rural bus transportation. Our rail division, kind of a regulatory arm of the organization, making sure working with class ones and the short lines to make sure that the product, goods, and services moving up the rail lines through and within the state of Oregon are as safe and efficient as possible. Safety, safety oversees kind of the four E's for all intents and purposes, whether it's engineering, enforcement, education, or emergency services. They bring together all the stakeholders to move forward in the area of safety. Driver and motor vehicle services, DMV, again, maybe the face of government for all intents and purposes. People won't interact with our good folks at DMV at the counter sometime during their life more than likely. Motor carrier transit transportation division, again, that's the relationship we have with the trucking industry to make sure that the trucks moving up and down the highways are as safe and efficient, as well as the drivers. So regulatory relationship, but a strong partnership, making sure the economy of the Oregon is not compromised in moving our product. Mr. Psyche's division, Central Services, again, the administrative arm of the agency, and then we have the good folks of communication that help tell our story. That is who we are. That is what we do. That really is the kind of the opening salvo of where I'm going to go. I'm also going to speak about major achievements that the agency has seen, and I would submit that they are major achievements for this legislative panel as well as your colleagues in the whole, because they are the investments that have played themselves out dating back to 2001, to be very honest with you. I'll speak about the focus of the agency this legislative session, kind of the surgical strikes on issues. Look at the long-term issues. Those are the issues that I put in here that keep me up at night for all intents and purposes as we look to the horizon and those transportation challenges that will come before us. And then finally, the chairs have drafted up 7 questions that were provided my agency, and I'll do my very best to answer those 7 questions, which will culminate my conclusion. So I've identified the Department of Transportation. I look at our mission, and I have you read it, to provide a safe and efficient transportation system that supports economic opportunity and livable communities for Oregonians. The bottom line is that is a multifaceted mission. We serve many masters, and we do our very best to serve all those masters to provide those opportunities. We're governed by a 5-member governor-appointed transportation commission. It's chaired by Gail Achterman, who is from the Portland area. Mike Nelson from Baker City is our vice chair. We have Alan Brown, former member of this committee, from Newport. We have Dave Lohman, who's down from the Jacksonville-Medford area. Then we have our newest member, Mary Olson, who comes from the Oregon City area. Those 5 people are our board of directors for all intents and purposes. The rules of the game there is no 3 can be of the same political affiliation, and 1 member must be from east of the Cascades. So they make up our board, and they also are charged with delivering the mother of all transportation policy documents, the Oregon Transportation Plan. That's the overarching umbrella direction for the agency in terms of policy. It's made up of components of the various modes, be it highway, be it transit, bike, ped, so on and so forth. It is a 25-year long-term vision of what a multimodal transportation system is here in the state of Oregon. I also point out to you a document that is, I think, a very fine reference document specific to the Department of Transportation. But the state of the system articulates how my agency is doing as it compares to the 7 goals contained in the Oregon Transportation Plan. So a document that gives you a wealth of knowledge, but also the direction that this department is going in light of the policies forwarded by the Transportation Commission. So again, that's who we are and what we do. Let me turn my attention to the major achievements. And as I said, these are achievements not only for this agency, but I would submit to the legislature and the transportation industry as a whole. We have seen investments that have played themselves out in 5 consecutive legislative sessions. They are building a more healthy transportation system, a more healthy multimodal transportation system. But maybe most importantly, it has also provided paychecks for Oregonians at a very critical time in our state's history here. So we have much to be proud of. I turn our attention to the latest investment that we have seen in transportation, the 2009 Jobs and Transportation Act. Really a document that played itself out in 2 ways. 1, a very focused investment, prescriptive in nature in terms of infrastructure throughout the state of Oregon. And 51 projects were chosen with some bonded money, and it spreads across the state of Oregon. Embedded in the Jobs and Transportation Act was Connect Oregon as well, the multimodal $100 million lottery-backed bond investment strategy. So again, we had a full investment on the infrastructure side. The second part were the policy and initiatives that were embedded in the Jobs and Transportation Act, and I'm happy to inform you that we are engaged in each and every one of those. Some of these efforts have culminated with documents and reports, but again, significant policy discussion that plays itself out on how we choose projects. The project selection criteria was reviewed, putting down an economic lens as one of the variables that make up how we choose transportation solutions. Practical design, looking at the way we plan and develop corridors now, making sure we are maximizing the flexibilities that are built into the standards, trying to wring out as much money as we can along a corridor to provide the best solution that extends the investments that we have. Least cost planning, interesting concept that was literally lifted from the utility world and dropped down into the transportation world. This is one of the issues that we continue to work on as we try to sync up the supply and the demand conversation specific to transportation challenges and transportation solutions. Greenhouse gas emissions, again, ODOT among a handful, or less than a handful, of state agencies. Our friends at the Department of Energy, DEQ, Land Conservation and Development, are working on various scenarios, eventually culminating in rules and targets for our MPOs, focused mainly in the Portland metro area, but rippling through Central Lane, then out to the other MPOs throughout the state. Let us look at the relationship between transportation and land use. What scenarios can come into play in terms of bending the greenhouse gas emission line here to try to seek some of those percentage reductions by certain time frames that we have in statute. Congestion pricing pilot, again, looking at three opportunities in the Portland metro area. Might there be a way to make some investments using congestion pricing? We are piloting those type efforts, and again, more will come at us as those continue to mature and develop. And then finally, outsourcing maintenance. Here's an opportunity that's playing itself out in the Washington, Yamhill, Marion County regions on Highway 219, stretch of highway. We'll pilot over a 6 to 10 year period. And we will see what the cost associated with outsourcing versus the in-house cost, and have a, as best as we can, an apples-to-apples conversation about the opportunities that that pilot presents. I mentioned Connect Oregon. Again, we can reach back as to the 2005 legislative session. That's when Connect Oregon was animated. We saw success in 2007, and as I said, embedded into 2009 was Connect Oregon 3. Simply put, we have 166 multimodal projects that, again, are displayed throughout the state, delivering about $300 million of investment that break down the barriers for moving commerce, goods, and services. It is a multimodal investment. That really is the way we can fund non-highway investment, by using those lottery-backed bonds. It has been an extremely successful program, and I will tell you, there's some language that will come before you and your colleagues to look at Connect Oregon 4. And as you may have read yesterday in the governor's budget, the governor has placed $40 million for a Connect Oregon 4. So we continue with what I believe is a very successful and beneficial program. Going back to the 2001, 2, and 3 timeframes, this is where we saw the Oregon Transportation Investment Act, or OTIA 1, 2, and 3, present themselves. Nearly $3 billion of investments that played themselves out on pavements, on bridges throughout the state of Oregon here. It also allowed us to engage in a new delivery mechanism by outsourcing the project management of the team. And I will tell you that that relationship with the joint venture of Fleur Daniels and HDR has been very successful. The Connect Oregon 3 bridge investment of $1.3 billion is, for all intents and purposes, on the bell lap, the last lap of the race here. And we are on schedule. And we are on budget with that big investment. It was about jobs, for all intents and purposes. I think all these investment strategies, while they wore a garment of transportation, they were really jobs bills when all is said and done, and it proved itself beneficial. Again, speaking specifically about OTIA 3, we know that about 85% of the money expended to date have gone to Oregon firms, so we put Paychex and Oregonians' hands. We have seen over the life of the program, which was a 10-year program, an annual average employment of about 2,300 people. So you can carry that out. Significant boots on the ground because of this type of investment. So very successful on the state side. We turn our attention to some federal stimulus monies that came to the state of Oregon in 2009, specific to overall transportation investment from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. We saw about $500 million come our way, $334 million specific to highway transportation, of that $100 million directly to our local government partners. But we delivered those projects very quickly. Sole principle, for all intents and purposes, was for my commission to select projects that we could put the work boots on the ground. Again, you see a theme playing itself over here. We were one of the first, if not the first state, to break ground on the Recovery Act projects, and we have moved very quickly to deliver that program. For all intents and purposes, we are just about complete in delivering everything that came at us here. learned our lessons with working with Federal Highway Administration. We did some very good things with our federal partner here in terms of helping secure programmatic permitting, and I'll speak to that a little bit later, and allowing our local government partners to get their projects on the ground very quickly because we bundle up the permitting process rather than taking things in an individual manner. We bundle those up and we move very quickly to deliver those types of projects. So an impressive display of work and focus to deliver the federal stimulus. Turning my attention from highway now to rail here. We have seen success over the last decade, about $250-some million invested in improving safety, the mobility, preserving rail lines that would have been lost without these types of investments from both state and federal sources here. So we are better off. We are seeing improvements in terms of ridership, and over this time we've seen about a 13% increase in ridership, which is one side of the coin. I would flip the coin in saying there is a challenge specific to not only rail, but also transit. And this is how we fund transportation in the state of Oregon, and specifically how we fund non-highway transportation in the state of Oregon here. The bottom line here is we struggle every year for all intents and purposes to make sure we have a stream of money that can continue to invest in just the basic planning, maintenance, operations, and capacity needs of the rail system. We have to fight every year. We can't use gas tax dollars here. That makes it very challenging, and the federal conversation, with all its uncertainty, is clouding that discussion as well. I think it brings us to a point where one of the most significant, and I'll speak about this a little bit later, but one of the most significant policy discussions that we will have before us now and into the future is how we fund transportation in Oregon and how we secure a sustainable stream of money toward rail to make sure we're taking advantages of the valuable contribution that rail makes. And the same applies to transit here. We've also seen investment in transit. There have been some champions that sit on this committee that assure we make infusions of money into transit. But we have to fight very hard for that type of money because it goes up against some other very important type issues here. And again, the uncertainty at the federal level is causing some challenges as to where we go. But our investments have yielded some tangible benefits, some visible benefits to the transit system here. We've seen overall ridership increase about 15%, and we've seen senior disabled rides up 20-some percent. Now, the need continues to grow, and the need far outstrips the revenues we have here. And I've explained how difficult it is for us to secure money here at the state to fund the non-highway programs of rail and transit here. Again, significant policy conversation as we look to the future. The issue of safety. We are blessed to have the good folks at Transportation Safety. Troy Costales is a gentleman who's at point for the safety program, but he's blessed with great people. The state of Oregon is a national leader with regard to safety. If you look at the history, over the last 11 years, we have seen a decline in fatalities here in the state of Oregon. It's just not a peak. Some places across the state see a 1 or 2 year decrease in fatalities. 11 years, I think it's unmatched across the state, so something to be very proud of. We are actually seeing percentages more in line to where they were in the 1940s and 50s. That's how successful we have been. And we've been successful because it is a true partnership with the various stakeholders that make up the safety community, whether it's law enforcement, whether it's the coast, the courts, whether it's the emergency services folks, or just the transportation safety advocates. They have come together. They have made things better and safer for the traveling public in terms of the way we engineer solutions, the way we educate and engage driver behaviors, the way we respond to emergency services, and working very closely with the enforcement side to place sanctions on those folks that are breaching the various rules and protocols. A discipline within the state, and speak something about Oregonians, we have always one of the top three percentages of seatbelt uses. We are currently at 97% of folks using their seatbelts. We have seen a reduction in teen driving fatalities and crashes, whether it's the teen or the people that may be hit in a crash that involves a teen driver. We have seen significant reductions in terms of those types of fatalities in the orders of 50s and 60%. This just didn't happen by accident. There was a concerted effort to look at graduated driver's license to get a little more time behind the wheel. And then we have driver's education. We want to make sure that these kids understand the significant responsibility and obligation they have when they get behind the wheel. And I will tell you, we will bring some language before this committee that will seek to continue to make investments in driver's education up in the Portland metro area, the three-county area, because they have the capacity. But what we do know, if we can get these kids early and we can get them trained, they will be safer, their friends will be safer, and all the folks driving the roadways will be safer here. We've also seen, again, another concerted focus effort in terms of at-fault truck crashes. We've seen a decline of 28% along those. Again, it's the regulatory relationship we have, and you have an industry that safety is their number one goal, just as safety is our number one goal here at the Department of Transportation. A very solid partnership that has yielded a tangible result in the reduction of at-fault truck crashes. I spoke to some extent early on some streamlining efforts, and we've seen this present itself in terms of the way we secure environmental permits. As we move projects, this is a critical path in delivering a project, but it also can be an area where time is chewed up and project delivery is extended here. I think we've made an investment of time, energy, and talent with our regulatory agencies at the federal and state level. The bottom line, it comes down to a simple formula here. We tell them we will do something, and then we do it. And the level of trust and confidence continues to be built. They know what to expect. And that's why they've allowed us to move into programmatic permitting, because, again, we say, here is the type of project we're going to do. This plays itself out over many projects. You know the protocols. Past will be prologue. Programmatic permitting is playing itself out. I will tell you that benefits in terms, the benefits accrue in terms of time. We shorten the project delivery period. It also benefits us in terms of money. And going back to the OTIA 3 process, using programmatic permitting and bundling up these types of bridges throughout the state of Oregon, we avoided $73 million in cost to the taxpayer here, because we didn't have to approach every bridge, do an analysis on those single bridges. We bundled them up. So again, a savings of time, a savings of money. We also have been recognized at the federal level. In 2010, we received the National Partnership for Highway Quality's Making a Difference Award for partnering. Again, another tangible example of the outcomes that are being realized here in the state of Oregon. In terms of sustainability, here is where the Department of Transportation is also a leader. As I have the privilege of sitting around the table with some of my DOT friends from across the country, they look to the state of Oregon and the leadership the state of Oregon is providing in terms of sustainability. We are the first DOT in the nation to have a fully engaged sustainability plan here. We have looked internally in the way we do business. We have looked externally in the way we do business with our business partners to see if we can maximize the opportunities in terms of recycling, in terms of savings, in terms of the way we do business. Again, we believe an investment in sustainability yields a dividend as we look to the future here. We've tried to be creative and innovative, whether it's our solar highway approach as we try to generate our own renewable energies to run the operations of the transportation system. We have piloted. We're ready to take the next step in terms of that. Electric charging infrastructure for electric vehicles. Again, we're trying to make sure that a person can travel from Portland to Ashland and not have the range anxiety, because we have the infrastructure along the corridors to plug in that. Those are just some of the examples of what we're trying to do in terms of the sustainability pound and the long-term future of the conversation specific to transportation and how we invest. We've listed some bullets here in terms of just some of the brass tacks of the savings that are realized, whether it's energy consumption, whether it's recycling of waste, how we reuse things, how we bring things back into the system here. Again, the bottom line, we are reducing energy consumption. We are lowering the agency's carbon footprint. We are using water in a more efficient manner, and that commodity is priceless. We are being less wasteful, and the results of that are cost savings to the taxpayers of the state of Oregon. One final thing before I go to the focus on 11-13 is something that reaches back to the mid-1990s here. but it continues to reap a dividend in terms of economic and environmental benefits. And that's our Green Light program, going back to our motor carrier division, the trucks. The privilege of driving the highways, you've probably seen those gantries that hang over the interstate that the trucks drive through. That's our Green Light system. We have 21 way stations. The Green Light system, again, it quickly, at highway speed, it checks the credentials, the documentation, the size, the weight, the registration. And if everything's a go, they can continue down the highway at highway speeds rather than pulling in to the port of entries for somewhere between a 5 and 8 minute check-in if all things go well. So what does this mean? It means products, services, and goods are moving more efficiently through the highway. But let me tell you what it means in terms of a number of truckers saved an estimate of over a million hours of travel time, $131 million in operating cost. And I will tell you there is a commiserate benefit in terms of fewer emissions being spewed into the air when a truck goes into the port of entry. So again, we've seen an economic benefit. The trucking industry is seeing an economic benefit, and I think that will, to use a phrase, trickle down to the bottom line of the consumer. We'll see a benefit because of this investment. For 12 years, we continue to reap dividends from that. Transition to where we are right now in our focus or our work plan for all intents and purposes for the 11-13 biennium. Again, coming out of the 9 session, the Jobs and Transportation Act really framed the work plan for my department, the work plan for my commission here. So we will continue to deliver on the legislative funding proposals. Again, I spoke about the 51 projects totaling about $960 million that was backed by $840 million of bonded funds. We will deliver those projects with our local government partners. We will deliver the Connect Oregon projects and continue to move that project forward, hoping we can secure the next investment through Connect Oregon 4. The OTIA Bridge program, as I said, we are running the bell lap on that, and we will run on time and on budget. Another issue I want to focus on, and that's the Columbia River Crossing. Significant conversation that's playing itself out. I want this committee to know that we will continue to move forward through the NEPA process in an effort to secure the record of decision from our federal partners here in the 2011 timeframe that moves us into final design and right-of-way purchase in 2012. And if all goes well, we will construct that critical piece of infrastructure in 2013. The benefits, be they economic, safety, environmental, I think speak for themselves. But most importantly, I would remind folks of the jobs that project alone offers the opportunity to bring about 20,000 jobs to the state of Oregon, to the construction trades that are going through some very challenging times. So we will continue to stay focused on that. The Oregon Wireless Interoperability Network, OWEN, we have seen a course correction here. Recall that my department took that on April 1st of last year. We tried to get a better handle on exactly what we had taken on. It is a critical, a mission-critical radio system here. I think we have a better understanding of what the scope, schedule, and budget of a big, full-blown program is, but the governor's direction in his budget is to say, hey, look at a different pathway here. And over the course of this legislative session, we will work to make sure that we secure a direction where we can communicate and move forward with that approach. Those are our work plans. There are 1,000 other things I could have mentioned, but again, as an overview, just a quick snapshot of where we are. I'd like to end this part of the conversation with some of the long-term major issues that I see in front of us. And as I said earlier, kind of the way I see these things, these are the things, if I wake up in the middle of the night, that don't allow me to go back to sleep. I start to worry about them because, again, it is looking to the future. We have done a very good job of taking care of the present, of taking your investments, improving the transportation system in a multimodal sense. We have a very healthy infrastructure now, but you don't have to look too far out in the future and see that the capital programs are going to start to decline. We're talking 2015, 2020, 2030, where these realities are going to be in front of us. They demand action now. We can't wait till it is upon us. They demand action now. Let me speak to some of the issues that we have before us. As I said, if you look at the way the investment has played itself out with the OTIA programs, the Connects, and the Jobs and Transportation Act, what you'll see is a peak. and a downward slide from 2015 on. That's because we're delivering these programs for all intents and purposes. So this assumes if nothing happens into the future here, what we will see is the pipeline, the queuing of projects will be flushed for all intents and purposes. They will be delivered here. So we have an opportunity to have conversations in the future. But we're on a declining capital program that takes us to almost the minimum type investments in terms of capacity, the minimum type of investments of maintaining some condition ratings on bridges and pavements here. We also have just the financial reality that we use bonding. We've actually socked away now to pay the debt service monies that existed in programs. We actually, in the OTIA program, took money out of the existing bridge program to the tune of $25 million, complemented that with new revenue. But that secured the opportunity to raise that $1.3 billion to invest in those critical freight routes. I would remind this committee that we had identified a universe of about $5 billion of challenged bridges. I'll get to that a little bit later here. But we have a declining revenue source, capital program. We have bonded debt service that suck up money as we move forward. And then we have a significant conversation that's leading nowhere at the federal level. Uncertainty is the word to the wise here. We have a trust fund at the federal level that has had to receive an infusion of $35 billion of general fund money just to maintain the payments of the expenditures that we have. The bottom line is that the expenditures have far exceeded the revenue coming in. So again, I don't think there is a sustainable pathway to continue to go at the federal level to the general fund and transfer it into the highway fund here. What that means, if there is no activity from the federal level in terms of increasing the federal gas tax or some other financial mechanism, and it's ironic that the federal gas tax was last increased in 1993. That was a similar conversation that played itself out here in the state of Oregon until recently. But there's no movement or sense of urgency that would dictate to me that that's going to happen. And maybe that's just the political reality, the financial realities that they're dealing with. But that said, what it means is the potential for a 20 to 30% cut in highway and transit programs. Already when we're seeing revenues that are flat or just dipped a little bit here. So you can see what we are seeing is the combination of issues that's putting us at a financial disadvantage in terms of maintaining the health of infrastructure here. One final thing, the composition of the fleet, fuel efficiency. We're seeing cars that get much better mileage. We're seeing the transition to electric vehicle or alternative fuels, but mostly electric vehicles. Those vehicles are great. We are actually investing in that program and its infrastructure. But that said, right now, we have no mechanism to collect monies for the use of the system here. There will be a conversation that plays itself out. Rough Tough was animated in the Road User Finance Task Force was animated in the Jobs and Transportation Act. And they're going to look at this. What is the appropriate user fee for folks that don't go to the gas pump to generate the investment back into the system, the transportation system that they use? But our world has changed. We have to, I think, really breathe life, whether it's at the state level here in Oregon, and we've certainly pioneered the gas tax transition to a mileage-based fee idea. We are playing that here. We'll see it come again in a different iteration, so to speak, with a very focused intent. We are also playing it at the federal level because I think, again, the financial realities, the math's just not going to work as we move to the future. So one final issue before we get to the financial that goes into the condition ratings is, again, and I've mentioned it a couple times already, one of the things that I think is the most significant policy issue that we must deal with, or at least cast the seed, hopefully, onto fertile ground, is the way we fund transportation. We're challenged, as I said, in the non-highway modes here. We need to find some sustainable flow of money. The lottery back bond investment of Connect Oregon has served us very well, but again, that competes for a lot of constituencies compete for that type of money here. We need to be forward-looking. If we truly want to call ourselves a Department of Transportation, if we truly want to say that we are multimodal in nature, we have to find a funding source that can fund non-highway investments. The last thing I want to do is create a bloodbath over the trust fund here in the state of Oregon. But the bottom line is I think the transportation sector can come together and be collaborative in our approach rather than competitive in our approach here. And I think that's a conversation that we need to take on. It's difficult, but I think the capacity there is there to engage the issue. With those financial realities, with revenues moving in the wrong directions, and as we look to the future, again, uncertainty is the word I would use. What we're seeing the impacts or the implications in terms of bridge condition. Again, $1.3 billion in a surgical strike for freight critical bridges, but a universe of $5 billion exposure and liability. The state of Oregon, our bridges were built between the 1950s and 70s. They are coming to the end of their life cycle. They will be past their shelf life. The strain and demand on aging infrastructure is taking its toll. What we will see is a decline in bridge condition rating without further investments here. We have strategies. I just don't put a problem on the table without some strategies. I will tell you the department is moving and exploring different ways to make sure we are as efficient as possible in terms of bridge preservation type strategies. We highlight four here, separate focuses on our coastal bridges, our major lifelines to make sure we haven't compromised folks getting to and fro. A new and a developing bridge maintenance strategy that will extend the life of the decks on these types of bridges. High priority freight corridors, again, will be front and center always. Because the link between transportation and the economy is undeniable, and we want to make sure we honor those commitments of moving goods, services, as well as people through our corridors safely and efficiently. We spoke to the policy initiative of practical design. Here, again, is an opportunity to focus on the bridges and to see how we can maximize the various standards and flexibilities built into those standards to get the best bang for the buck, to coin a phrase. Implication to pavements is pretty much the same. We actually see maybe a quicker move in the decline of pavements. We have one of the best pavement ratings across the nation. But again, without the appropriate levels of investment, we see that starts to die. That has implications in terms of maintenance investment, because if the condition ratings start to dive down, you try to invest a little maintenance on that, you get too far down the road there, and as you move from fair to better to worse, the cost exponentially grow. And we try to find the sweet spot in investing in our pavement strategies. Again, we have some strategies that we will deploy to make sure that we continue to do our very best with our level of effort and investment and preservation of our pavement here. The final thing I'll end on with the kind of the overview is workforce. There is no question that if we are going to be successful, or if we are going to fail, it's going to depend on the people we have within the organization. That is just a basic fact. I truly believe that. We do our very best to make sure that we maintain a qualified and diverse workforce at the Department of Transportation, but there's some realities facing us. We may be, I'm not going to say unique, but maybe one of the state agencies that have an older workforce. Maybe it's just the cut of cloth of people we get, or maybe it's the type of work that we have here. But I think of all the agencies, our average age is 40-some years old at the Department of Transportation. I think the next agency is like 35, so it's a significant movement here. To put it in stark realities, and by 2014, 35% of the employees at the Department of Transportation will be eligible to retire. And just 3 years later, that percentage goes up to 50%. So that's the institutional memory, the collective wisdom that we have right now. I need to maintain and retain that wisdom and that knowledge within. And at the same time, I have to make sure that people understand there is great opportunity at the Department of Transportation. We are aggressively pursuing kids from across the United States to become our engineers as well as our electricians here. And we have an aggressive recruitment area, because I need to attract those young, bright, diverse, and qualified kids into the organization. So I'm trying to find that sweet spot. Those are the things that keep me up at night, as well as several other things that float in and out of the Department of Transportation. As I said at the beginning of this conversation, I truly believe this, we do have some of the best and brightest individuals in state government working for the Department of Transportation. We have a capacity there. But I think these issues are so challenging that we need to partner with you and your colleagues as we take these things on and move forward into the future. I think the collective wisdom of this partnership and the partners who make up the transportation sector can help inform this discussion, inform the direction, and inform the decisions we make into the future. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's my overview. I stand ready to take any questions specific to that, but my next step would be toward the seven questions, and I thank you and Co-Chair Reed provided my office, and again, I look forward to engaging that conversation. So,
thank you, Matt, for that overview. Are there questions from the committee? Co-Chair Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm wondering, I appreciate the as usual, comprehensive overview and good material you've given us. One piece, I had some constituents come to me and point out a specific passage of House Bill 2001, which I will plead some ignorance on since I didn't have the good fortune to be on the Transportation Committee in the last session, that talked about recommendations and considerations about regional approaches to funding transportation. And I just wonder if you could give us a little update on your thinking about that and how the my recollection is that the language had to do with coming back with specific recommendations and where that process might be.
I'll be very honest with you, nothing jumps to mind as a specific initiative. I will tell you, and maybe Chair Benz can help, there was a significant conversation about when we make an investment, does one size fit all? In terms of the needs of, let's just say, Eastern Oregon, where the need really is highest in terms of maintaining and preserving that infrastructure there. The issues of capacity are there, but they are surgical. They are not the significant needs of a Portland metro area here. So, again, when you look at investments, we just kind of one size fits all, so to speak, and it blankets out, and we have our equity splits and money flows. We did something a little bit different in terms of the way money was allocated to Eastern Oregon. That sent it in a different manner, giving the opportunities for those jurisdictions to select the projects here. I would also say that we're trying to inform that regional conversation through our area commissions on transportation to make sure we know the highest priority of investment there. Those are the two issues specific to regional decision making. I'm always wondering as we craft investment strategies, does the one size fit all really scratch the itch? And in my gut, I believe it does not. But it's kind of the way we are doing business here. I think we do have to look at how much money we want to make investment across the state of Oregon, but then surgically target where the need truly is. If the capacity issues are in the Portland area or in the Mid-Willamette Valley, let's focus that investment there and let's send the preservation dollars out to Eastern Oregon so they can keep those lifelines, for all intents and purposes, in the best condition and level of service as we can. That's kind of the conversation that bubbled up.
Mr. Chair, may I clarify? I think
please.
I might have asked a question that might be sending you in the wrong direction.
Okay.
Director, when I meant regional, when I said regional, what I meant was more about the governance, so that if we're talking about ODOT versus metro versus local government, that sort of question, where the dollars flow and who is helping to manage and make the decision. So all that you've said so far I agree with and that's helpful, but I think
you're being kind because I was walking down a completely different pathway. Governance is a significant issue. Mr. Chairman, we've had some discussion on the issue of governance, but we have not exhausted that avenue, to be very honest with you. It wasn't something that a lot of energy and effort was put into. It was a difficult conversation during the Vision Committee, and the governance discussion was kind of a subset or a subgroup of that. And they made some ideas, but it really never resonated to any extent. And I think it was embedded in the Jobs and Transportation Act, and I think maybe the charge was actually the legislature's charge. We've had some discussion with our local partners to make sure that we are maximizing the transportation investment. And we've looked at the way we invest in various regions. We've looked at the way that we partner and maybe co-locate and something. I think those are low-hanging fruit type conversations. We haven't had the discussions, although I think the good folks up at the Portland City Club looked at maybe turning the model on its head,
right,
and doing a significant restructuring. Right, wrong, or indifferent, it was a good academic piece. I'm not sure if it really played itself out realistically on the ground here. So we haven't gone very far down that pathway by design or just because the focus was on delivering projects.
Mr. Chair, just a brief comment. I think that's very much the question that was asked of me, and I would suggest that might be something that the committee might take up as a discussion as we move forward.
Madam Vice Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I probably can't really shed a lot more light on it than Director Garrett has, but it did come out of the governor's committees as we were preparing for the bill, and there was an interest in the governance committee to do this. It's just, and then it got put in the bill, but there was not really a lot of ownership after that. We've had a few discussions about it, what we wanted to do with it, where we wanted it to go, but nobody was really jumping on this one as to do something. So it probably is something that needs a home or a leader, because we were not very successful over the interim following up on that and trying to.
I think one final thing. At its core, it is a significant question to answer. I think on its face, there are too many cooks in the kitchen. You have 300-plus jurisdictions, and that may be a low amount, of folks that have their finger on some transportation, a part of the transportation debate. I'm sure that's not the most efficient way to do business. We should pursue it, but again, I think the plate was very full, and it was just how do you prioritize. So there's been some commission conversation. We've actually brought some folks representing different jurisdictions in. I think we've skimmed the top. There's a deeper dive ahead of us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quick, Mr. Garrett, the projects that were given last time, is there a breakdown on when those will be started or when you're looking at starting those? Because these are issues that we hit with the constituents and stuff, so we can tell them when ground we'll be breaking on.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Representative Wydern, we can get you a document that articulates the timeline, the status, with regard to all the projects that were included in that Section 64 of the bill. So happy to give that to the committee, and we can share it, and hopefully it answers some of your questions, and always, if you have any additional questions, my folks will be at your door.
Okay. We'll go down the line. Vice Chair Sheehan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Director Garrett, thank you first for your presentation, and you and Robin Freeman have been really accommodating to me and all my questions that I've had in the last few weeks since being appointed to this committee, so thank you for that. I have some questions that I put on paper, and if somebody hand this over to... This started off as a constituent issue. I had the Rock Creek Exchange is happening very close to where I live, and I spoke with a constituent who owns some of the tracts of land that are sort of earmarked for that, and he obviously has trouble marketing those pieces of land when you've got this project coming in, but he's mm-hmm. not really getting any timelines on when that's going to happen. And one of the things that he mentioned was it would be the perfect time to buy right now because of the fair market value of the land is so low. And I'm wondering if this might be something that might pop up in other areas. So my questions are, and you don't need to write this down, it's coming to you, but
okay.
What parcels of land need to be acquired for ODOT projects that are currently in process? What's the fair market value of those, if you can find that information? And what might be the fair market value of those parcels maybe 5 years ago, if the data was available? Otherwise, maybe just run a little depreciation on them so we can see kind of where we are. And that way, maybe we can look at there might be some opportunity in prioritizing acquisition of land versus the development of land at this point when the land prices are so low. So I'm curious about that, and I was wondering if you could get back to me by mid-February.
We certainly will. Mr. Chairman, Representative, I think there's a conversation scheduled with Mr. Mather and our Region 1 manager, Jason Till, and they can speak to you about the activities that are playing themselves out on the Sunrise, what we have money for, and then kind of the future conversation. This is a financial discussion, to be very honest with you, but I appreciate the opportunity to take those questions, and we'll put answers to those questions.
Yeah, and I just want to clarify that this would be for all the open projects that ODOT has, just in case there's some opportunity elsewhere.
We'll do our very best. It's going to come down to money, though. I can tell you that. That's an easy answer.
Thank you.
You're the first non-chair or vice chair I've been able to, you know, recognize Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sort of. Thank you. Sort of. Mr. Garrett, there are several kinds of programs or services that the state delivers that more than one department is involved in accomplishing the objectives. For example, early childhood services and education. We've got Department of Education, Department of Human Services, and quite a few separate agencies. Another example is in water quality. The water quality area, we have Department of Agriculture, Department of Environmental Quality, and two or three others. Different departments, all involved with some piece of ensuring water quality. In workforce training, we have community colleges, K through 12, business department, and several other departments, all doing something. And when I think about the need to restructure the delivery of government services, can we really keep doing these fragmented approaches, not only to budgeting, but even to assigning missions and objectives? When I think about the area of transportation, it's not so clear to me that there are a number of overlaps with other departments, but are there certain areas of services that you deliver that you share with other departments, and how is that coordinated?
It's an excellent question. Yeah, there is overlap, whether it's the transportation land use conversation we have with DLCD, whether it's the economic opportunity that plays itself out with Business Oregon, whether it's the environmental, the water quality type issues with DEQ, or whether it's, you know, kind of tangential and a very difficult conversation that we haven't been able to crack, but education buses kids. They move kids through buses. We've got a transit portfolio here. Mm-hmm. So there is the overlap. Let me go back to the main. There's also issues with housing in terms of jobs and transportation balance, again, because that can compromise a transportation system if the housing's over here and the employment's over here. Mm-hmm. So you can see that that transportation, and I'll be somewhat parochial to transportation, is a hub issue with many spokes, and it crosses over. What we're trying to do, and I think we have made a concerted effort to invest time in the partnerships with my sister agencies, whether they're regulatory or not. I mean, but what we're trying to do is better align our policies to make sure that the state is speaking with one voice in terms of transportation, land use, and economic opportunity. And we believe if we can get on the same page there, that eventually we get on the same page with investment strategies. So we start to target the investment, and you yield an outcome rather than worrying about the process here. That is a strong effort that I think will only be enhanced with some of the direction that we're receiving from Governor Kitzhaber and his regional solutions approach. Bring in these folks. Have that focused discussion. Look at the policies, and where there is overlap, do we complement each other or do we collide with each other? And I would submit there are times we collide, and that's not good for anybody here. So we're working very hard to make those investments, and we're seeing a growing opportunity to bring in sister agencies. We do know transportation touches people's life every day. And so how do we make that better in light of the relationships we have with sister agencies? So we're working on that. It's an excellent question. And we cannot do business the same way, because I would submit the traditional ways of doing business, they don't answer the questions anymore. They do not answer the questions anymore. So.
Thank you.
You bet.
Other questions? Smith, and by the way, I was tardy in not recognizing he was a new member of our committee. Happy that you joined us.
Happy to be here. We'll see how long it lasts. Why are you guys laughing?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Two questions that both could might be sort of after-meeting questions, sort of,
sure,
you know, offer answers. One is sort of a homework question, getting a rough lay of the land of projects happening in the metro area east of the 205, you know, near and east of the 205 corridor. And then second is getting a sense of what the most seismically and structurally challenged bridges are in the state. you know, which are the ones that are, you know, the most likely to collapse and make us all look foolish?
Sure. No, Mr. Chairman, Representative Smith, those are conversations that are current with us, and we have information that we'll bring to you. Happy to bring those back to you and inform you on both issues.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
Further questions? Just a couple remarks. The comment about the involvement of local governments and your comment about the one size doesn't fit all couldn't be more clear from how 2001 played out on both sides of the mountain, because, of course, in my district, it's relatively simple to go to Burns and gather together the interested parties. A little more difficult in Portland.
Sure.
And so when it came to designing the appropriate application of the funds that were allocated to that area, it was easy to say what's best for the community and ask the local folks. And the answers were fairly, I don't want to say obvious, but there was a lot less argument, a lot less discussion, fewer people, fewer roads, fewer systems.
Sure.
So it is interesting to see how challenging it is for your department to manage those different situations.
It's to your point, Mr. Chair, I can tell you that prior to 1997, prior to the creation of the Area Commissions on Transportation, we were having those individual conversations, whether they were from Eastern Oregon or from the Portland metro area or right through the Willamette Valley or Central Oregon. All those jurisdictions would come to my commission and just tell the commission what the concerns were, what they needed. What we have done is we have better informed the debate where we can bring some type of focus and at least discipline to the transportation debate, and those priorities start to rise to the top. I've said this often, and I truly mean it, that one of the best decisions the Oregon Department of Transportation or the Oregon Transportation Commission ever made was the creation of the Area Commissions on Transportation. We now have, I think, 11 of across the state that inform this discussion, that help bring focus to the transportation debate. And it is a much more educated debate, being, to be very honest with you. It's not the parochialism. There's been a maturing of that conversation, where it's just not all about highways anymore. It's a multimodal in its nature, and we bring them into the Connect Oregon discussion, and they have influenced and directed policy conversations. So we are better than we were. We're not perfect. We have a ways to go, getting back to the governance conversation. But we need to do more. We have to make sure when we strike right at the target.
And this may come up in your response to the chair's, co-chair's questions, but we've had a dramatic reduction, as I understand it, in the volume of dollars that have come to the department, because, of course, you had the influx of $500 million or so from the federal government. What's that done to the department's, when it comes to size and folks working there? Did you have to ramp up? Are you now ramping down? What's happening?
We have pretty much stayed flat. And remember, the way we accommodated the OTIA investment that drove the volumes up significantly was to outsource, for all intents and purposes, to engage this joint venture, have them bring in the private sector folks. We have a kind of a in-house outsource principle or philosophy that guides how much is outsourced based on volume here. But with the huge increase we saw with the OTIA investments, we went outside. The last thing, and the discussions were clear, the last thing state and government needed to do was to bring 400 to 500, maybe 600 people to accommodate the investment that came in 2001, 2, and 3 with the OTIAs. Because eventually that program will end and you'll have to let those people go. We've held flat. If you look at where we are now, as to where we are now going on a decade, you will see the Department of Transportation has stayed about 4,600 people. So we have maintained a discipline. We have a discipline in our policy option conversations as we move to your colleagues on the budget committees, the Ways and Means committees, that if indeed there is an internal initiative created by the Department of Transportation that warrants additional FTE, then we will find it. It is our ideal, and if it's so important, we will make the adjustments within the agency. The only time we bring forth a request for new people, is when we have an external mandate coming from us, whether it's from you and your colleagues or whether it's from the federal government. And all we ask for is a conversation. We'll do our very best to make the business case as to why we think we need new people, and we'll take what take what you give us.
One last question for the moment. The concept of lower amounts of funding available gets a little muddled in maintenance on the one hand and modernization on the other. And so maybe you could share with us how close we are coming now to just maintaining. You suggested that we ought to shift to maintenance on the east side and maybe keep doing some expansion on the west. That's what I think I heard. So is that the fallback position that we will look at the outlying areas? I want the measure to be more than just distance and number of people. Unless that is the proper measure.
Well, Mr. Chairman, it's a good thought. I think that is part of any matrix that we look at. But that said, if you go back to the policies that are embedded in the Oregon Transportation Plan, with various revenue scenarios, you get to a point where you are triaging the system. And you triage the system just to maintain and preserve the transportation asset. That's kind of where we are right now. Again, we've seen the peaks, and we will have a very good construction year next year. Again, the volumes will be as high or very close to the volumes that we saw this year or this last construction season, which was one, if not the highest construction season we've had in the history of this agency. But we're going to start to see that fall off as the OTIA programs come to completion, as the connects, and then as the JTA. And remember, the JTA had projects that were ripe and ready to go almost the first construction season, but that extends out to the 2016-2017 timeframe. And there's only 51 projects, so spreading across it, the volumes aren't that high. You see, again, as I say, when we get out beyond 2015, we start to see that capital program. So we start to migrate toward that maintenance and preservation and triaging the system. We are very close to being there right now.
Then, with that, possibly you could address the questions.
Sure.
And keeping in mind, of course, that the overriding theme of this committee is transportation/economic development. So our interest in that first question is actually Chair Reed's. We're hoping that you're going to say something that suggests getting closer to more economic activity. So with that lead in.
As opposed to less, Mr. Chair.
Yes, exactly. Thank you.
We stand ready, Mr. Chairman, to receive anything to create that economic activity. I know it's a difficult financial time here.
Encouragement,
a pat on the back, but, you know, a little skin in the game doesn't hurt as well, and we stand ready to deliver on that should it come. So, again, when I speak of transportation, I clothe it in the garment of economic opportunity. That's the way I see it. I guess just in terms of protocol here, I will read the question, and then I will share my thoughts, and hopefully I'm shooting toward the target. The first question that came was, define for us, from ODOT's standpoint, what you believe would be a successful 2001 legislative session. Now, I've had some conversation, but I will tell you these answers come from me as director, because I think some of these are just gut calls here. And I think there are three things that jump at me that when we run through the tape at the end of June or whatever it should be. If we walk out of this session and the confidence in my agency is as high as it is right now, because there is trust, there is the respect that we show you and your colleagues and a respect that you show my agency. If I can maintain that, that's a success. And let me tell you, that is number one, that we will treat things that come to us from you and your colleagues with professionalism and respect. And we will give you the full story. We will tell you what we think. We will tell you what others think. And we will hopefully inform your discussions and your debate, which yield the results of a stronger transportation/economic situation for the state of Oregon. So confidence and trust, I want to maintain that. That's extremely important to me. I also want to maintain the notion that you see this organization as a partner, that, again, you generate the revenues. You take the risk of raising fees, and then we deliver on them. Again, it is not about process, protocol. It is about outcome and that partnership relationship. I want to maintain that. I've spoke to the challenge we face with regard to funding. I want to lay down the seeds for a policy conversation of how we fund transportation in the state of Oregon and how we can create a revenue flow to the non-highway modes. I think it's incumbent upon us, if you want your Department of Transportation to truly say with confidence that we are multimodal, we have to have that conversation. We have to identify that. And I think that demands we bring all stakeholders around the table, not exclusive to the modes. We bring the highway folks in and the non-highway folks and have this debate to see if we can find a solution. If we maintain the confidence in the partnerships, which means we are just delivering on what you give us and executing the programs, the policies, the practices, and the initiatives, that will be a success. If we can maintain some of the significant policy conversations now and into the future that yields a result of how we can have the most robust, healthy transportation system, which I think equates to a robust and healthy economic state for Oregon, then that's success. That's success. There'll be 1,000 little things that we do, the administrative type stuff. But looking back, those are the three pillars that I would hope to achieve. Moving to your second question, and please believe me, I'm not trying to punt this at all, but this is a very difficult question that comes up, and there really is no matrix that gives you an apples-to-apples view of how states compare, and specifically within some of the sub-items that you have here. The question is how does our state measure up to our neighboring states in cost per mile? There is no cost per mile equivalent here. Each investment is different, just whether it's geography, geology, just the, whether it's an urban setting or not, they're difficult. We have cost per mile numbers here, but as we move from there, we look at new roads, the maintenance of roads, snow removal and planning, et cetera, et cetera. So we really have no good matrix, and we can go to our national trade associations, ASHTO, the American Association of State Highway Transportation Officials, and they don't have anything as well. We did find something that speaks to the issue, maybe one off, and it is a report that came out in September of 2010. It is the 19th annual report on the performance of state highway systems here. And this is a document that comes from a gentleman by the name of David Harkin. He used to be with the University of North Carolina. He would produce this report for the last almost 20 years. He's now a senior fellow at the Reason Foundation, and the Reason Foundation being, I think, a libertarian think tank for all intents and purposes. This is a project that's not without controversy. Everybody gets all sparked up about it because there's volatility in the way it's reported, but I will just speak to what it says about the state of Oregon as this tracks kind of the performance and the effectiveness of state highway systems across the nation. And it takes its information from the Federal Highway Administration, so it's kind of a neutral thing. For the state of Oregon, we are ranked 10th in the nation this year. And the paragraph reads, Oregon ranks 10th in the nation in state highway performance and cost effectiveness, an impressive increase of 13 spots from last year. And then it goes on to say Oregon ranks 29th in total highway disbursements and 23rd in fatalities. It goes on and lists various details in it. But you can see that we have moved, and at least judging in 2010 of all the questions they ask, and they're looking at mileage owned by the state and the maintenance disbursements, the capital and bridge disbursements or allocations, our condition ratings in urban or rural interstates, fatality rates, deficient bridges, narrow lanes on rural roads and such. They use that matrix. We've done quite well. It's a volatile matrix, so to speak, because we were, I think last year, let me see, it indicates that we were 22nd overall, at least in the 2007 study. I think they may be a couple years back. I think this is probably 2008 information that informs this 2010 document. So there's some volatility of it. So in trying to ask your question, I can give you what would be if, you know, just trying to hold constant, the cost to pave an urban section of the state versus a cost to pave a rural section. And then I can start throwing the caveats. Do you just mean the black of the asphalt, or do you want all the features that go with it? And you can see that when we get to comparisons, the apples to apples soon become apples to pineapples. That's not to punt. But I think that's just the reality. But we can start to drill down, if you want, just some specifics to the state of Oregon. But there's not the good matrix that walks us across. So I hope that works. The third question, much has been said about privatization and the money it may or may not save. A few words about the pilot privatization programs would be in order. Let me speak to two issues, and let me speak to the most current, and I mentioned it early on, is one of the initiatives embedded in the Jobs and Transportation Act, and that was the outsourcing of a stretch of highway, a 26-mile stretch of highway on Highway 219. The Oregon firm of Eagle Elsner, I think they're out of Sherwood, if my memory serves me correct, I could be wrong there. We just handed over this piece of roadway in 2010, and they will look to maintain that piece of roadway. The activities will include basic pothole and patching and drainage, vegetation management, the mowing, traffic signals, the striping, the signing, the winter maintenance type activities, including snow plows and de-icing and sanding. What we tried to do is take a piece of roadway that experiences everything. It's got a little bit of rural, it's got a little bit of urban in it. We made sure there wasn't the volatility of weather, that they're going to get a little snow every so often, they may get a little ice, but not so much that it demands significant investment in snow blowers or plows here. So what we've tried to do as best as we can is create that level playing field. So as we move forward in this pilot, we can come forth with how much it costs the private sector to engage and then hold that up against what it costs to do that internally, to try to take all the factors and level that playing ground. So we are underway in that effort right now. We are literally in the first inning, as I said, since we handed over the contract in December of 2010. But this is something that has been an issue since I've been at the agency. And depending on what side of the argument you're on, you're going to argue it that you will make money or you will lose money, whether you in-house, you do your services in-house or you outsource the project here. Well, we will inform that with this pilot specific to maintaining a stretch of highway here in the state. The second issue is, and I spoke about this as well, was the joint venture, the public-private partnership for all intents and purposes that we used to deliver the OTIA investment here. What we saw was innovation and creativity. I would submit to you that the programmatic permitting was the collective wisdom of ODOT and this private sector consortium coming together and then engaging the permitting issues, and we've reaped benefit from that. Overall, the engineering disciplines cost what they cost. And so when all is said and done from a financial perspective, you might not be able to point saying, oh, yeah, that saved us money. But there's certainly innovative and different techniques that we can take from that program and embed into the Department of Transportation and our day-to-day business here. So, Mr. Chairman, those were two issues with regard to privatization that we have playing itself out and culminating in what I will say is a successful effort by the Bridge Delivery Partnership, that joint venture. And then we're right on the cusp of learning a little bit more specific to maintenance here.
I hate to have to hurry you along, but better hurry you along.
I'm going to I'll buzz through it, and it's not to give you these great questions short shrift, but I will move very quickly. The wages and salaries of those working for the states are better than many of the wages paid for similar jobs in rural Oregon. People often line up for the opportunity for getting a state job, explaining why this is the case and explaining how ODOT is addressing control of these and every increasing cost would be helpful. Well, simply put, we don't have a piece of the compensation puzzle. We have a sister agency, the Department of Administrative Services, that sets the compensation rates. As I said, our challenge is to make sure we bring the most qualified and diverse workforce to get it here. I would like to say that they want to work for ODOT rather than some of my friends at the county just because they have a great director, but I'm not sure that's the case. The bottom line is I've seen this cut both ways. When I was the Region 1 manager, my folks literally could walk to the city of Portland or to Clackamas County and make more immediately. I lost a lot of good folks. So while the shift may be a challenge in rural Oregon here, the shift is a challenge here in urban because I lost some good folks because they could make more money working for local governments up in the Portland metro region. The bottom line, how the compensation is set is not our charge here. What I want to make sure is we have an environment that can attract the best and the brightest within this organization. Question 5, observed that the department's excellent attempts to involve everyone in the decision-making process makes for a lot of process. A very few words on how the department thinks process might be or is being reduced, expedited, refined, because it could go on all day. This is a fair question here. The bottom line, we have some authoritative documents that exist at the federal level, surface transportation, bill, safety, lieu, directs that we engage folks, and there's kind of a disciplined protocol in the way we plan and engage folks. We have our own state policies. Our Transportation Commission wants to engage communities in the transportation debate. The bottom line is what we try to do, and while certain conversations can go on, forever. Most conversations yield an outcome here. And what we try to do is take the vision of community and integrate that with the vision of the agency, whether it's an engineering vision or what we believe is the appropriate solution, and combine those. And when we do, I think we have an outcome that the solution is embraced by all here. We do run into those issues that the conversation seems to go on and on and on. Those are the exceptions. They are not the rules. I will tell you the department focuses on the outcome and not the process, and that's what we try to bring resolution to. Number 6, identify the greatest impediment to the transportation system. I don't think I need to tell you that I think it's how we fund transportation and the challenges we face in making sure we have enough funds for the highway portfolio and making sure we have a sustainable flow of money to the non-highway modes. And then finally, the last question, a mention of the transportation planning rule as a lead-in to the planning for transportation versus the environment versus the economy equals a more planning circle. Not a death spiral, but a circle, but a conversation that needs to take place. Because, again, if we can align our policies, I think the state of Oregon is better than aligning its investment strategies, and that's going to be good for all of us. I will tell you whether it's House Bill 3379 that really had us codify the way a local government needs to engage if indeed they can't meet the requirements of the transportation planning rule in terms of compensation or capacity increases. We have outlined that. We have a joint commission between DLCD and the OTC to take this on to inform the TPR conversation. This will play itself out in access management conversations that will be discussed during this legislative session. Again, we are doing our best to make sure that we find the balance in terms of economic opportunity, environmental stewardship, and transportation safety and operations. And if we can find that sweet spot, then that means our policies have aligned. We are meeting our mission to provide that safe and efficient transportation system. We are promoting economic opportunity, and we are delivering livable communities for the state of Oregon. So it is an effort engaged at the highest levels of the agency and at the highest levels of our commissions. So with that, Mr. Chair, that exhausts the 7 questions.
Thank you very much for those answers, and I'm sure if we had another 3 hours, we would skewer you with questions about them. Are there other remarks or questions for the director while we have them? See none. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
Forward working with you over the next 5 months. Before we end this part of the hearing, I want to mention and recognize for purpose of the record the letter that all of you are handed from Keith Petro. And we're not taking any testimony on it, but it's in the record. Is that appropriate for your purposes? Thank you. Okay, the next thing on our agenda, we have an update on the Pacific Northwest Economic Region 2011 Summit in Portland. And do we have Representative Schaffler? Okay. We'll stand at ease until Representative Schaffler arrives. Committee will come back to order. We are now going to take up the Pacific Northwest Economic Region 2011 Summit, and we have Representative Shopler. Thank you for leaving Judiciary. Bring them up, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I thought these guys were going to fly solo without me. I didn't know the good co-chair was going to come fetch me. I'm Mike Shoffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, out of Southeast Portland. I appreciate the opportunity to introduce my colleagues from Penware here today. I described it on the floor. I don't think I have to do that again. I've been representing Oregon at Penware for 8 years now. It's been a great experience for me. I get to fly all over the region, meet a lot of interesting people, get a great perspective on this rather large, very rich, very diverse region. And I hope you all can come to our summit in July. We have a lot to talk about. We have a lot in common. We have a lot of common ground and to work together, especially when working with our federal, our respective federal delegations on not just going north and south, but east and west. We have George Groenfeld, from a member of Legislative Assembly from Alberta, and Matt Morrison is our executive director. And I'm just going to let them take it from there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Basically, I just want to thank you all for your support.
Sorry,
of
if you could state your name for the record, please.
Matt Morrison, executive director of Penware. For your support of Representative Shoffler, as he is our incoming president of Penware this year, and in July we'll take over the helm. And he's done a masterful job of representing your state in your surrounding jurisdictions. We are excited to come to Portland. Just a few highlights. We will be doing a symposium on the Columbia River Treaty for legislators from the entire region, across border. We're looking at a program of global trade partnerships focusing on the Asia-Pacific region, and in particular have invited Secretary Locke to do a roundtable with businesses to look at the National Export Initiative that the U.S. government has launched, and if there aren't great opportunities in partnering with Canada. In the United States, 60% of all companies that export anywhere in the world export only to one country, and it's Canada. So we think that there's a great opportunity to really build on that successful trade relationship that we have. And we'll be looking at, in terms of export promotion, exactly what is the federal government doing. We'll look at engaging with companies, a list of resources for companies to understand even how they can participate in exports, how they can take advantage of the two-way trade with Canada as well. I also, before I turn it over to George, I'd like to mention that we've worked a lot on the Amtrak Cascades train from Eugene to Vancouver, and I think that our efforts have really been on how we can enhance the competitiveness of the corridor, and especially with the Washington State investment of $1 billion into that corridor and the near now $750 million coming from the federal high-speed rail funds, there's a great opportunity to enhance multimodal rail infrastructure. And I really want to stress that it has to have a multimodal approach. We're looking at freight and passenger infrastructure improvements. And I think that we'll have a great deal of focus on that at the Portland Summit. Our members are very interested in coming to Portland. We'll be looking at a Legislative Energy Horizon Institute, where 60 legislators will come from around the country to study energy infrastructure. And we'll also have a university president's roundtable looking at university consortia on addressing key issues in the economy of the region. Those are just some of the things, and I'd like to really encourage all of you to attend. It's July 19 to 22 in Portland. And let me turn it over to George Groeneveld, who's a legislator from Alberta.
Well, thank you very much. And as was mentioned, I'm George Groeneveld, member of the legislature from Alberta, former agriculture minister, so that's kind of my forte. But I'm going to deviate from agriculture, even though we do over $200 million with the state. I'd like to see that go up a little bit, but we'll work on that. But I want to, what I'd like to talk to you about just for a couple minutes here today is the our oil sands in and energy in northern Alberta, and perhaps trying to dispel some of the myths that are out there. I'm not going to do that here. We are going to make a presentation in a half an hour in front of another Agriculture and Natural Resource Committee. And we were going to do a full PowerPoint there, and anyone who would had the time to look at that, I think it's well worth watching because it explains in great detail what we're doing up in northern Alberta and with our crude oil out of the oil sands. But just a couple of numbers I'd like to throw past you is the I want to talk about the validity probably of safe and secure oil probably to this part of the country and indeed to the U.S. As a whole. And I guess maybe it becomes more paramount right now when we see what's happening in the Middle East right now and the value of some of what our oil sands could be for the U.S. and indeed for us. And export a lot of our oil to the U.S. as it is now. It's interesting to note for every dollar that the U.S. Spends on the U.S. Crude oil, 91 cents comes back to the U.S. And if you look at the chart that we have here, Mexico comes in at 73, and then it goes down dramatically after that from the dollars that come back to the U.S. So it's certainly a point worthwhile recognizing. The impact of the oil sands on the U.S. economy, the output and the GDP, this year alone is $23 billion. And probably to hit a little closer to home here, the impacts of the oil sands on the economy of Oregon, and the economic benefits and development and production do not fall solely just to one region of the country, of course, but in this year alone, the GDP output to Oregon was $162 million, and it goes up to It will go up to $493 million in the next 10 years. So the other issue is the oil sands development and the U.S. jobs. The oil sands at this particular time, and not only the oil sands, we have about 60,000 jobs for specialty people right now in Alberta that we can't fill. And I think that's worth taking note of because although we have unemployment figures that we don't like, I think we're at 5.1% right now, so probably a little better than the average province and probably indeed the state. So I think we could do some a little bit of horse trading, if you will, with the Oregon people because of the fact you have some well-trained people down here at the particular time. I think at the increase in employment in person years for you here right now is 172,000 jobs just from the values that you come from the oil sands. So I'll just stop there. If anyone would like to see our presentation later, if they could do that, I think it's really important. We kind of were in some bad publicity of the oil sands, which indeed I think we can disprove. We've had some of your elected representatives, including Mike, up there to show them. It's kind of an open invitation to any elected official that would like to come to Alberta. If you can get as far as Calgary or Edmonton, we'll get you to the oil sands and show you firsthand what's going on there. So thank you very much for your time here.
Thank you. Questions for our panel?
Mr. Chair, before I go into that, the benefit of Penware's given me is just that. I mean, I've been to Prudhoe Bay, seen the measures they've taken up there to protect the environment while they get good American oil and bring it down here safely. And I've toured the oil sands, and I think it's 17% of our crude comes from Canada.
Yes.
And, you know, the Canadians are our friends and our neighbors, and they're not interested in changing our way of life or blowing up my house or anything crazy like that. And it's a good investment, and I really encourage you all to try and get up there. But I do want you to definitely come to the summit, and there'll be people from all over the region. It's really, really, really helped me be a better legislator, and I just encourage you all to just check it out and get them. And I want to thank Representative Nathanson for coming to, and Representative Beyer for coming to our winter meeting to talk about trains. So we have a lot in common, and I appreciate the opportunity to introduce them to your committee here. And I don't think Matt talked about the Columbia River Treaty that's coming up, where comment period opens in 2014. That obviously we'll all be very interested in that. So thanks again, I appreciate it.
I heard there's a rumor that they're going to keep all the water in Canada, dam off the river, prevent it from coming this way.
Well, Mr. Chair, they may as well, because we ain't using enough of it here in Oregon.
did you arrange that exchange with Representative Shuffler in advance, or was that just a happy coincidence for him?
It was a happy coincidence. Representative Lindsay.
So I don't know how Canadians feel about this, but I know Americans would love to see Representative Shoffler without this goatee. I think he's looking pretty handsome there.
Well, thank you, Representative.
In all seriousness, so I actually work with a handful of Canadian cross-border transactions in my personal business, and a lot of people in Kelowna doing that do a lot of e-based marketing and sales. And they've come to me with a handful of issues of wanting to market from Canada to Oregon. And Oregon, of course, I think you cited some of the statistics that I think Oregon's even a bigger trader than Washington. I'm not sure about that. My specific question is, can you identify any specific Oregon policies that may make it more difficult for Canadians to do business here in Oregon off the top of your head? If not, it might be something to follow up on a little bit later.
Well, I won't, you don't have to do it, George, I'll do it.
Good.
They have an identification system for cattle in Alberta where every cow gets a chip. This is incredibly sensitive, controversial, and our Cattlemen Association has opposed it for years, and I will never try and force them into doing anything, but this it makes it difficult. We have one sick cow down here in Oregon, the whole state gets shut down. If they're finishing, I don't know if you take an American cow up there and finish in Alberta for Montana, if they have a chip on it or not, but you know, it would protect our beef industry if we had a more, I guess, effective, fail-safe way of identifying where meat came from. And it would just help the entire industry. I think George is a cattleman. I got no cattle but a big hat. So, but I think that's a pretty sensitive issue right there. It's a big issue. It's very controversial. I'm not interested in weighing into it, but you asked, and that's one that jumps out at me.
Yeah, and that Mike's absolutely right. Right now, I think we have feeder cattle come up into Alberta, but they don't have that radio frequency tag in their ear, and they can't be age verified. So those cattle pretty much have to come back to America for slaughter and consumed back here in America. So that's just a small portion of some of the problems we're having with this.
Representative Widener, and then Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let me understand this. It's not a problem with Canadian animals coming this way. It's a problem with Oregon animals going that direction. Is that correct?
I don't think it's a problem going either way.
You're right.
They have a very, it's a foolproof way of identifying where a cow come from. And there's a lot of very good, valid reasons that our cattlemen don't want to do it. Invasion of privacy. They've grown a market. Forgive me, I can't remember the term. And if we use the chip, it would get rid of a certain marketing tool, and I'm not well-versed enough to speak to it intelligently. But here's the thing. If one cow gets sick and you don't know where it comes from, now they're all suspect. And it isn't just between Canada. Yeah, you know, we had a mad cow disease outbreak a few Christmases ago, and Korea and I can't remember a whole bunch of countries just refused to take our cattle anymore. Our meat for a long, long time, and that cost us a lot of money. And I was just one little example. The representative asked about something, and I threw that out there.
Yeah, the issue is our cattle are, and hogs, in fact, all animals 4 feet right now, are fully traceable. And so if there is a disease outbreak, and I think this is the important part of it, is within 24 to 48 hours, we can identify exactly which part of the country that animal came from, and then rather than shut down the whole province, we can just shut down that small area. Now, that hasn't happened recently, but it will happen again because it does seem to pop up. The other issue right now, and I hate to argue for this point that you should do it in the U.S. because it's giving us a leg up on the export market right now, particularly in the Asian market where all animals have to be fully age verified and traceable right now. But I think what's a little bit scary for us is on this side of the border, you're not doing that. If indeed you had a sick animal, as Mike said, or us, and you can't trace it, we're a fully exportable market. And pretty much, we export 60% in Alberta. That immediately would affect us because of we're joined at the hip with the North American relationship, which we should be, by the way. But we got it's not a very endearing term, but it's not bad. I don't think we live beside the big elephant. And we're always affected by what happens here.
Follow up.
Yeah, so there's not any big issue with it because I know I have a meat packing plant that has about 600 hogs a week coming into it from Canada, just in my own district. So actually in my own town. So there's no problem with us not doing it. It's just a traceability issue that Canada would like to see the U.S. do.
It depends on who you ask, Representative.
Okay. If I just make you, because you've opened up a little can of worms,
that's right,
with country of origin labeling, that causes a problem for the hog industry.
Complex issue. Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to mention how much I appreciate the existence of this partnership organization. And I have a special interest in it now, in particular, as Representative Schaffler has mentioned, since I'm focusing a lot on the need to improve our rail system, because I believe very strongly that our state and our regional economy is already somewhat hampered and will be greatly hampered in the future if we don't improve our rail system, and that's in regard to both moving people and moving products. And since we are heavily dependent on exports, whether it's exporting to other places in North America or exporting overseas, we've got to be able to make sure that products, agricultural or manufactured products, can move into those into the export arena. And we've got a system that's pretty much, at least in Oregon, the freight side is at capacity right now. And when the economy rebounds and manufacturing should go up, I don't know how much it can go up if we can't get those products moved in a timely manner. Anyway, I appreciated very much being able to come to the meeting some months ago and talk about shared interests with our sister state and sister country. And I'm very intrigued by the notion of planning not only for bi-state but bi-national arrangements.
Thank you. Other questions? Just a couple of remarks. First of all, thank you very much for being here, Representative, for bringing them. I would encourage the state of Washington to build the first part of its high-speed rail right across the Columbia River. At 750,000, yeah. 750 million would build part of it. The other thing is, I'm just curious, are you still logging in Canada? Do you still cut trees up there? It's a rare event here.
Still logging?
Yeah, logging, yes.
Yeah, we do. Even at Penwar, that forestry is one of the issues that we just kind of leave alone a little bit. It's a touchy subject.
Yeah, we don't want to talk about softwood lumber. That's all there is to it.
our committee is hugely interested in anything to do with encouraging the export market, so I think all of us will be watching with interest the presentation you're going to put on. I'll go down and attend at least a portion of it. I hope you're first. And thank you again for being here today.
Thank you.
No further questions? Are there?
One more thing, Mr. Chair, and then I'll leave. But British Columbia recognizes hydro as a renewable source of energy, and I think Oregon should follow their lead on that excellent piece of policy. I hope everyone on the committee agrees with me on that one.
Thank you for that, Ranger. I noticed a bill that has something kind of in it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Nothing further. We are. Okay. I'll close the public hearing, and we are adjourned. Thank you.